If you're a wine region affected by travel restrictions and uncertainty around in-person events, then Interpreting Wine's 100-Day Wine Brand Evolution Playbook was made for you. This complete program leads and supports you step by step to implement multiple powerful marketing channels in your business. It's also guaranteed to deliver over 500 hours of wine trade engagement in 100 days or your money back. Learn more at interpretingwine.com/brochure. I'm Lawrence Francis, host of Interpreting Wine, the place to learn from thought leaders in the world of wine and marketing, welcoming you to the 2022 Wine Communication Series. Across these six episodes, I'll be exploring modern wine communication and marketing in the company of some of the world's leading wine podcasters, traveling virtually from Australia and New Zealand to North America via China. With the influence of podcasting and social audio forecast to grow yet again in 2022, get ahead of the curve with this special series to be released every fortnight between January and March 2022. If you haven't already subscribed wherever you're listening, then sign up today so you don't miss an episode. We continue the series in the company of Emily Steckenborn, host and founder of Bottled in China podcast. Emily has lived in Shanghai, China for a decade, working with top-tier wine businesses in Asia, creating their beverage programs. Throughout her career, Emily and her team have trained literally hundreds of thousands of wine enthusiasts through nationwide trainings for government trade organizations, hotel groups, beverage brands, and multinational distributors. She founded the podcast in 2016 to share the stories and adventures of passionate individuals in the F&B scene who are shaking things up in Asia. Listed as one of the best podcasts in China, it has recently expanded to include a global trend perspective, hosting conversations with F&B thought leaders and business leaders around the world. Enjoy.
Well, thank you so much, Lawrence, for having me on. So I'm so grateful to be here. I'm a big fan of yours and your podcast and everything that you're doing. So yeah, it's been a decade now in Asia. I'm just stepping out of that for a few months as I'm out here getting my hands dirty at Ogong Tima in Santa Barbara and trying, you know, to understand really where wine comes from. I mean, everybody who's in Asia, sometimes, especially in the big cities, you're a little bit detached from the product. And so to be able to really get my hands dirty is something I've always wanted to do, and then heading back to Asia. So Asia is definitely an interesting region to be. It's, you know, coming first from Toronto in Canada. I've always wanted to do business abroad, and my dream that one day I could kind of catch that wave, the wine wave, right? Just like a surfer would for the wine industry in Asia was certainly very dynamic. And I think just to see the growth of the industry in the last decade has been really overwhelming. The educational aspect of that, I'm sure is of interest to you, has been such a dynamic player. And then just, you know, how the industry changes as a whole, not only in terms of people's wine knowledge, but also the government's way of working in China. And it definitely was a really long and interesting journey.
Amazing. And yeah, it would be great, I think, to ask you just to kind of paint a bit of a picture of that. Of that 10 years, really, you know, with the perspective that you've got now and able to kind of look back and see where you've evolved and how things have changed for you over that time.
Well, that's one of the things is that it's so difficult to paint 10 years in one picture. But generally, I think when I first came to China, I expected that the wine culture would be somewhat advanced. And I thought that we had to teach people how to drink wine and that mixing red wine with Coca-Cola was entirely wrong, or not pairing it with a specific dish. That was inconceivable in my eyes, because I was, you know, I guess brought up in a sense around wine. And then also thinking that our way of drinking wine was the right way, or only French wine existed. So I think what I've learned in the last 10 years is to embrace the way that the market has shifted and that people's consumption towards wine is changing or hasn't changed. And for the large majority, I think it's being able to step back and look at the industry and think, actually, maybe we have to do our own research about Chinese cultural elements and when it comes to wine and be able to be more open towards that. So the first thing I think I really learned is that wine in China does not need to pair with one specific dish. The way that people do consume wine is around round table, which means you have 10 different dishes coming at once. So how would you pair wine with different flavors, different spices, different, you know, just foods that we don't even see back in Western culture? So being able to embrace that part of it and then also embrace the side of business. I thought that, you know, doing business in China was very tricky and it's so layered and people would, have a lot of stories. Oh, I'll make sure your brand is number one. I'll buy tons of these cases or I'll buy a container load, and understanding that actually that's just a way of talking in business, that really a lot of people do have a big story. And what they're trying to say is, trust me, and together we can grow. So there's kind of always that gray part in China that when you do business, and I think it took me a long time. And for everybody I know, 1 year of living in China will not get you to understand the business elements. It really does take a decade and it takes a long time of building relationships. So I think coming into China, I was a little bit naive thinking every brand, if it's foreign, can succeed, or every person. And that is not the case. It takes brand development. And the brands that have succeeded in China have been there for over 20 years, building the brand from the ground up. And an element of luck when it came to the brand either having a name that is positive in China, and people don't even think of that, or a packaging like cork is still important in China. The varietal Cabernet Sauvignon or red wine or still wine is key in China. So there's a lot of elements that I've now been able to learn throughout that last decade.
Amazing. And I think you've potentially already brought up, you know, some of the stereotypes really that I think that exist in the West around, yeah, the right way to drink wine. And education obviously is something, you know, dear to my heart as well, and something that I'm sure we'll touch on. Painting slightly finer of the detail. Maybe sharing some of the roles that you've actually undertaken across that time. And again, reflecting on potentially any specific experiences that kind of stand out for you really across that time.
Right. So I was brought into China for the larger majority. My roles were really being able to drive the depletion once we hit into a restaurant or a key account. And the problem that we had, and for the large majority, were restaurants, because they would have the wine on the list and nobody would be ordering wine at restaurants. First, having wine with a meal in China is not what is normal. What is normal is that you would be consuming wine perhaps at dinner, but over business. So you would have the wine moment was a business dinner. It wasn't necessarily you going out with your friends enjoying a glass of wine. So wine by the glass was also very low volume for a non-Western restaurant. It was actually wine by the bottle. And that's really key in China. That's the first thing. So I was really brought on to develop these programs, both for large hotel groups, individual restaurants, key accounts, distributors, and finding ways that we can actually drive depletion. Also by raising standards for the WSET. So that was something that when the WSET was actually working in China, you probably have heard recently the news that the last year they have ceased their operations due to, we won't dive into that, but of course, one is the certification. So in China, you legally, even if you're teaching WSET, it would be considered an educational license, and only the government can provide educational licenses. And also an individual company needs to open up a license within their parameters of work. And that is for most places, you do not do that because that's a very sensitive topic in China. So there's a lot of ways around it, although we don't think of you need to be a university to teach WSET. So we were teaching WSET to support both internal and external customers gain knowledge about wine, because we thought if we can equip them with the knowledge that they need to sell the wine, we will all be in a better position. The consumer will be able to have a good experience. That's one. And of course, the other thing that I was doing alongside my roles with Woolworths, Treasury Wine Estates, also Beimade Xinhua Jiuzhang, which is North American premier when I first started, always kind of revolved around the educational aspects or brand ambassador aspects. And you would think, are brand ambassadors necessary in China? And you know, for small brands, I'd say probably not. A sales rep is great, but in terms of treasury, we were doing over 1,100 events yearly, and with a team of six. So you can just imagine that, you know, our KPIs were almost every day you're out on the road training or hosting dinners. And when we would host dinners, we would do a minimum of 30 people, but most likely around 100 to 300 people per dinner. So that's when we need the brand ambassador, because what we're doing is we go on stage, do a presentation, meet every single customer, try to interact and show face. And why are we doing that? Mm-hmm. Well, in China, you'd be asking, what's the use of having a dinner with 200 people, right? And if you ever go to China, the idea that you are a distributor who puts on a big dinner, mm-hmm. goes up on stage to create this allure of confidence in your consumers, and also show that, hey, we do have a real partnership with a brand, because there are fake wines in China, showing that, yes, we are actually the designated person to showcase these brands. So it gives them credibility. It gives them a chance to network. It gives the brand a chance to show that they're also in there to drive growth. And then also our chance to educate the public about the brand, hopefully to stand apart from the hundreds and thousands of other brands that are in the market, right? And because education was so low, people didn't even know what is red wine or the difference between white wine. And so we would have a small chance to be able to educate the public at large. So we're doing that, and as well as doing some PR for the company. So that alongside a lot of other things, but I would say the main driver was around education and building the brands within China and Asia.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like a fascinating journey. And I'm sure so much has changed over those 10 years as well, which again, I'm sure we will touch on. One thing I think, again, in my own mind, I think would really be helpful would almost be to kind of, I guess, talk about the geography then across which you are undertaking that role, essentially, to give us a sense of, I guess, city by city, perhaps, or in whatever way makes sense. Give us a sense of, you know, how what were the sort of nuances really within the audiences that you were speaking to and presenting to?
Yeah, well, that's a big question. I mean, when I was at Treasury, I was head of education for Asia. So that is, of course, not only mainland China, but I would say a lot of my focus was on mainland China just because the business potential, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the other thing is, if we just dive into China, China is a very interesting market because people categorize China as one region, which it really is not. The consumer that you find in the key cities, we call these tier one, Shanghai, Beijing, Shenzhen, Guangzhou. That's considered tier one. Those are your cities where you have high economic development. You have a spending, a population that makes higher income and therefore can spend it. And luxury products are definitely key. Now, this type of consumer in those key cities, they're very eager to learn. They probably have gone through their WSET. And those who are interested have either traveled abroad. And that's where I think a lot of people come in, is they've either gone to school abroad or university abroad and come back with a passion for wine. Mm-hmm. The consumer in tier two. Now, tier two and tier three, tier four, we can go all the way down. Those are usually smaller cities and small too. I mean, China standards. So let's remember that. But, you know, when we say a small city, maybe it's still 15 million. Yeah. And these cities are, I would say, the most fascinating and interesting cities. So we're talking about Chengdu. And Chengdu can, again, would it be considered? Yeah, it's definitely tier two. You're thinking about other like Hangzhou, Suzhou, Nanjing, right? Those are small cities out of the main big cities, but still have strong buying power. And you're probably going, well, if they're not the biggest cities, why do they have a buying power? And the key thing is business relations. So the first thing I would just say is that in these smaller cities, the people who are consuming wine, this really is for gifting. And this is really for business. You still find these highly engaged consumers, but they don't have the wine bars or the cafes that you would in the big cities like Shanghai. The people who are purchasing here, they're going after a brand. So the experimental drinker, that's definitely in tier one. And we see that as well when you think of England, right? London, you're probably going to find interesting natural wine bars. But in smaller cities, you find your everyday wine bistros. So same thing in China. The consumer there is after the brand. And we were really fortunate at Treasury because Penfolds at the time was the most important brand. In fact, if you researched on Taobao, which is an e-commerce site, wine, the other thing that people would look for is red wine, and then they would look for Penfolds. So Penfold was considered the brand, right? And so this consumer here is very highly brand driven. And that's where you hear a lot of stories where the Chinese only want to drink Bordeaux, or they only want to drink Lafite. And it's because they maybe don't have a lot of wine knowledge. So they hang on to a brand that they think is the right thing to buy, right? And wine is still considered a luxury product. So it's a safe investment. And afterwards, it just gets, you know, you can get into smaller cities, and likely the large majority there are buying to drink wine and to do, again, business. It's a lot of gifting, and the key gifting periods are in two key sections. You have February, which is going to be the Chinese New Year, and a huge also rush for selling, which is the Moon Festival. And that's generally around September, October period. So those two key seasons are really where, you know, it really takes place in terms of sales. And in terms of consumer, it's a very diverse segmented market. And it's hard to generalize everybody. But the key things that I've seen is that everybody thinks Chinese consumers drink sweet wines. That is not the case. Everybody thinks that Chinese consumers need even sweetness in their red wines. And again, that is not true at all. Brand, in my view, is the most important thing that you can do. Credibility and packaging, your taste, the idea that people drink sweet wines like Moscato d'Asti in China is not true. I've seen that in Japan, and I've seen that very much so in Korea, but I haven't seen that in mainland China. So people get that all confused.
And do you think that's, well, I mean, I'm really sort of, another question always leads to another question. But like, why do you think that may be? I mean, is that as a result of tastes kind of changing on the ground and people just haven't kept up with those changes? Or is it just kind of people just had those perceptions wrong from the very beginning?
Well, I think definitely there, being Canadian, I remember when I first went to China that ice wine was very popular. So I would say that, yes, sweet wines at one point were very popular. And then they really shifted when China started to open up. Mm-hmm. And they shifted very quickly. And I'll give you just an example. For example, right now, France represents 43%. And this is imports, right? Bottled imports into China. But in 2019, so only a few years ago, Australia was leading the way at 33%. Now it's in the only reason Australia is back to a very low number of 7% is because they added very high taxes in the last year and a half. And that's because there was a kind of a trade war in between China and Australia. So when government pushes for a style or pushes for a region, it very much has a lot of impact. And now they're pushing for Chinese wines. And China makes a lot of dry red wines because they're trying to emulate Bordeaux. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to people getting the perception wrong, first, it's because things change very quickly in China. What I've seen the market go through in the last decade probably took US or Canada 20, 30 years to get. So you can see how quickly it really does change. And also the consumer, I think, again, China's a big area. And I would see that maybe in North China, consumers are really used to heavy red wines because they drink something called Baijiu. And Baijiu is a very high alcohol spirit, which is the most consumed spirit in the world. And the south of China perhaps would prefer sweeter drinks because they're more used to having wine. And so it's a very different category and different style of consumer. But yes, and perhaps the misconception just comes from grouping all Asian countries into one, which I've seen when they think of Thailand, they think of Korea, and they regroup it into China.
I think it's a very clear answer. And I think it's like anywhere in the world, you need to stay up to date, and you need to, I think, stay current, which I think is a very nice link actually across to, I think an important part of what drew me to reaching out to you, which is your podcast Bottled in China. I think as well, maybe just to fill in for the listeners who may not have heard it yet, a little bit around how that came about and really, how did that potentially link across to the work and the roles that you've just been talking about?
Right. So I think traveling across China or Asia, and I would do that at least 250 days a year, whenever I would see things, and I would obviously get to meet a wide range of people. And when I would go back home or to Europe on business trips, people would just have such a wrong conception of what is China. They think, oh, you know, I'm sure you don't have any food there. And it's such a different world. In fact, China reminds me, you know, when I come back here, I think it's a little bit backwards. You know, that's how crazy China has been. And I would not be able to say that a decade ago. So that's just how insanely fast things move out here, out in China, that is.
Yeah.
So I was just a little bit disappointed that people first didn't believe in Chinese wines. They had a bad negative experience with Chinese wines, I would assume, 2 decades ago, which is understandable. And then they weren't open to it. And then they just thought, oh, all food in China must get you sick or it must be bad. And they weren't able to understand or wrap their head around how fascinating it was. And I thought, well, I would love to share the stories with people who are actually living in China, based in China, doing something. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the other thing is, and just like I'm sure you see all the time, whenever you see a great new research about China or a story about how to sell to China, you notice the person who's writing it doesn't even live in China or spent less than a week of their life in China. So I thought none of the information that they're giving, a lot of it's outdated, right? So one of the things is that I wanted to share the stories of the people with everybody and to really grow Bottled in China to be able to get this new consumer to understand what's really happening in this dynamic market. And then afterwards, it kind of changed in 2020, just because my interests changed as well, mm-hmm, to a more global approach. And, you know, we don't only cover wine. We did a lot of episodes about wine in Ningxia, but we also cover areas about sustainable food or alternative protein and just, you know, what the future might hold for all countries, but always a twist and angle on China.
Okay, I love it. Yeah, then that's kind of answered the other question that I had was, of course, around the title, and I was of course delighted to find such a rich seam of content on there, and I think it's something we spoke about last week actually. Just in terms of, I think a name of any content of any, yeah, any channel really, I think it's interesting because it's there to let the listener know what to expect, but I think also, you know, as we as content creators, as we go into different experiences, as we'll grow and we'll change and we'll get attracted to different things, and you know, have felt able to share travel content on Interpreting Wine and share content that focuses on spirits and whiskey and rum and gin and, you know, all these other things, which I think, you know, within kind of a standard deviation of people that like stories, that like good wine, they're going to like good food, they're going to like, you know, good experiences, basically. And I think that sort of, hopefully that will sort of maybe inspire people out there who, you know, who think, feel maybe a little bit constrained by a name they've given to their Instagram or to whatever channel, to think, you know, if something is interesting to you, then why not explore it? You know, there will be people out there who I'm sure also find it interesting.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, we talked about that. I was thinking, oh, should I change the name from Bottled in China to Bottled, you know, because I am out here for 3 months and I'm going back to Asia. But all these different things got in my head. And the reality is, I think that a lot of what I do cover is China. My background is, in terms of business, really China driven. And I always try to add an angle of China to whatever topic I do bring. So, you know, I'm very, you know, and also I just feel grateful for the opportunities that China has given me. So I do feel that it's going to stay a little bit like that for a while. And then we'll see in a few years what will happen to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I also find it quite comforting to just have that as an anchor as well, you know, to kind of bring me back. You know, sometimes if I've got too many ideas, I'm just like, okay, you're interpreting wine. Just, slow down, bring it back a little bit. But yeah, that's absolutely for myself and my experience. Something that's, I think also front of mind talking about podcasting. I mean, my main audience for the podcast is actually the US, and that's something that's, I think, again, you know, picking up that surf wave and riding really the growth of podcasting in the US. And I'm curious if you wouldn't mind, at a higher level, giving us a sort of a flavor of, you know, is there a big boom? Is there a big growth in podcasting in China? And then also, giving us a flavor of who's listening and maybe what might some of the feedback be, region to region.
Yeah, certainly. So there is definitely a huge growth, and the platforms are different. As you know, YouTube, Instagram, for the most part, Apple as well. They're actually blocked in China. So China has its own ecosystem, and that comes back to a lot of things when it comes to social media. The importance of social media in China is very is more than out here. I was just, I wrote out my bio and we got over 50 million social media views in the last 2, 3 years with my team. And would that be in US or North America? I'd feel like that was a big number, but this was all, most of it was organic and we didn't spend any money, So for the most part, those numbers sound crazy overseas, but in China, they're still a very small number given the current population. So in China, the main platform is called Simalaya, and Simalaya is an APP. But the thing that I've noticed is that either if you have an English speaking podcast, you're going to have a very, very small amount of people listening to it because, of course, English is not the main language. And the other thing as well is that if you are doing a podcast and it is in English, it's usually about learning about English. So it's not necessarily going to be a business topic. And just like yourself, if you have a second language, your first language tends to be what you listen to when it comes to podcasts because it is only audio. Visual, I think it'd have a little bit more flexibility because you could write the subtitles in English. But when it comes to podcasts, I think if you are going to dive into the Chinese market, having a Chinese podcast with Chinese language is the way to go. I would not probably recommend only focusing on the Chinese public for English podcasts.
Got you. Okay. And but I understand you, because you do record in English, you do also have a lot of listeners like myself in North America.
Right. And also, I think the idea of Bottled in China was to bring the story from China abroad. So I think that also, gets a new a new listener base in. And one of the things I think that's interesting just with the podcast, and you've seen that as well, is the, again, it's people who are interested in learning about China or interested in different topics that I think are a little bit more cutting edge. So most of the topics that we do have are not necessarily going to be only China, but like I said, they're a little bit more future driven, right? So alternative protein, a lot that we cover on that, and different types of things that perhaps also would be considered looking into the future.
I think the most recent episode I listened to was the one on ghost kitchens, and I think innovation that's been kind of driven from the pandemic essentially, and the all the pivoting that's taken place. And I just wonder, are there any particular episodes that stand out for you in terms of innovation and some of the things that you've just spoken about?
Oh yeah, I mean there are so many. So when it comes to innovation in itself, I like the whole ghost kitchen. That was with Matt Dean Pettit, who is one of the, I would say, a very celebrated Canadian chef. And he was just discussing that during the pandemic, they did everything through ghost kitchens, which means they actually set up a company and restaurants. They were growing during the pandemic, and that was only because they thought, actually, we can rent a kitchen from an existing restaurant and then be able to function from that way. And I think that's one way in the future. I mean, you look around and a lot of people now have gotten used to Uber Eats and all these different and platforms that now give you food at your doorstep. I wouldn't say that's necessarily too much innovation, but at the time that we were recording the podcast during COVID, he was a very early adopter of that. And he basically said, no more restaurants. We're going to be focusing on these ghost kitchens because it's here to stay. So I think that was interesting. But of course, in general, the podcast that we aim in terms of innovation, we've had a lot about, like I said, alternative protein that tastes exactly like Wagyu beef, or even that have crickets as food. I mean, those are a little bit more of the crazier ones just because it piqued my interest. But generally, a lot of the interesting podcasts, I would say, come back to China and wine, right? So a great podcast with Siga Estate in Ningxia discussing Chinese wines, the region, if you want to dive into that, or Shandong with Denise, who actually works with Lafite, that is their own brand, Domaine de Londres in Shandong, talking about, again, climate, region, and why Lafite started to make wine in China and other regions as well, like making wine in the desert and how they actually have to plow into the soil. And they use technology that oil rigs would use just to put in some nutrient into the soil because there's no nutrient in the sand. So there's these crazy things that China is developing in the wine region that for us seem a little bit interesting, but definitely are quite innovative in that space.
Yeah, incredible. And yeah, that was actually another one of the episodes that I picked out as well. And yeah, it was yeah, obviously, yeah, drawn to something new. And of course, you know, well, for myself, it was really, yeah, trying to learn about the regions and just, you know, get more exposure to a new region, which, you know, I know we're gonna sort of come on to in terms of giving a little bit of an overview in terms of the different regions of China for anyone who's listening and wants to learn more. One thing that I think is still quite new, actually, I think I saw it on your LinkedIn, is actually Bottled in China podcast appearing on Air Canada, which I think is really exciting for me to see, you know, a fellow podcaster, a fellow wine podcaster getting that sort of exposure. And I just wonder, yeah, if you wouldn't mind just, yeah, giving us a bit of a flavor of yeah, kind of how that came to be and how it's going so far.
Well, yeah, thank you. Well, we actually just launched just the beginning of the month, so a week ago. So it's too early to tell how it's going to be. But I think Air Canada does about 2 million passengers a month. So we'll see with the pandemic as well, because I'm sure that shifts some numbers. But yeah, you know, I think always, you know, being a Canadian, traveling all the time for business, one of the things is I always thought this is the type of consumer we need, right? People who are traveling, open-minded, perhaps even going to China. And, you know, Canada does have quite a large Chinese population as well. So the podcast itself, yes, we have two episodes. One of them is with Pilateri Wine Estates. Now, Pilateri is a family-owned business in Canada, and we talk about climate change in Canada and how they actually are building a brand abroad. And you know what is so fascinating, Lawrence? You would think Canada's in the best position for climate change because we obviously would need it. we could benefit from a little bit less snow. But actually, it's not the case. He was mentioning how horrible it's been for the vintage because it's a short growing season, a lot more extreme temperatures. And he was saying way more mold than ever before, just because it's the fluctuation in terms of rainfall. And it also is bad for ice wine production because now you have these short growing seasons and extreme winters or extreme rain or drought. And these things are just unseen. And so it's very difficult to predict even how we can manage ice wine. So we really dived into that. And I thought it was fascinating. And I hope that as a Canadian traveling around, I would want to learn about what's happening in my own country and how the wine is being impacted. And also how his tips about growing business in China is, again, I've seen Richard work the market. And the one thing that I've noticed is you got to go there. You have to be present. You need to work the market. And here I am today as we speak at Obon Climat in Santa Barbara, which actually has a huge export market in Japan. And Jim Clendenin, who sadly just passed away, said the same thing. How you actually grow the market is by showing up and being dedicated to the market. You can't go to one fair a year and go to an event and go out for restaurants. You need to be working the market, meeting distributors, growing that relationship, showing your face. You won't see the results for the first 5-10 years, but it will come one day and you'll be grateful that you did. And everybody that I've seen who's successful in China, be it Ernie Lucen, previously Etienne Huguel from Huguel family, who sadly also passed away a few years ago, they all show up to China, right? And that's what it is. If people want that connection to you, and it will grow slowly but surely. And the other podcast is about Chinese wines that we have on Air Canada. And that's actually a combination of our two conversations with Siga Estate and also Tianzai Vineyards out in Xinjiang province in China, talking about how difficult it is to make wine in China, why Chinese wines are expensive, and also a bit about the story of these two brands. So I mean, Air Canada really stemmed from a dream, and I have a wonderful team that I work with who made it happen. So it's definitely not just me. And, you know, we had to rework all the episodes to make it more of an NPR spot, which, you know, I'd love to, you know, pick your brain. I would love to have that style of podcasting in the future where it's much more of an HBR or NPR style podcast, but that's a lot more time and work. And, you know, it's always about managing those two aspects.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, you know, there are so many, I think there's so many exciting things happening with audio at the moment. You know, I really, really feel as though there's so many people who are, so yeah, pushing the boundaries really. And there's kind of so much creativity out there. And yeah, it absolutely does turn into a balance of your time really to explore the medium. But you know, it's something I would say, and you know, and just observe is, you know, I would love to see more wine brands and restaurants and wine regions and these people really embracing podcasting, because I just feel as though, you know, we're in agreement, you know, sample size of two, but we're certainly in agreement that there is a huge growth there. And you've spoken to the growth in China, which I wasn't so much aware of, but I've obviously seen the growth in the UK, the growth in the US, and a lot of big brands I've not ignored that. You know, they've gotten involved with that. You know, I read something a little while ago about, you know, Disney launches like 20 podcasts, you know, because they're Disney, and they realize it's, you know, it's worth a look. It's worth experimenting with. And the fact of the matter is that the barrier to entry is relatively low. And I think that actually, yeah, like you there, I don't know if any episodes are going to come out of your vintage there, but I'm sure this, you know, there'll be hundreds of thousands of people around the world who would really, you know, love to spend some time behind the scenes at Aubon Climat and really understand more about what they're doing and you know, the adaptations that they're doing. So, you know, long story short, I think it's a huge advantage, and I'm just, you know, glad that together, hopefully we're able to amplify that and hopefully, you know, draw one listener into maybe giving it a try and seeing what they might like to bring to the field.
Right. And I'm sure just like you, I get asked all the time how to start a podcast, and I always help out my friends to start that. And I think it's all about finding your voice, finding what you're excited to talk about. That's the most important thing, because it's definitely a long journey, right? And then it definitely is consistency. But definitely in my view is, if you have a passion like you do for wine, like you do for communication, then and you have a topic that you know fairly enough about to make the conversation, hold it, add your engaged point of view, then I think you've got something that you can work with.
Absolutely. And these, you know, winemakers and people who are close to hospitality, they're experts, aren't they? They work so hard. It's, you know, it's such a tough business that, yeah, they have that lots to share. And I guess, yeah, connecting onto that really, I'd really just kind of invite you to almost, you know, speaking of Air Canada, almost, you know, go up to a little bit the 30,000 foot view of your own podcast career, really. And I'm just curious, you know, really kind of share with us, you know, how many episodes that you've gotten out there, and essentially, yeah, maybe kind of synthesize a bit, you know, what do you think has changed in terms of the podcast itself? You know, what might people find now that they wouldn't have found at the start? And also yourself, you know, how do you think that you've changed and evolved as an interviewer and a communicator?
Yeah, I mean, so far we have over 135 podcasts, or probably more by now. And from what I've seen is that when I first got started, people were actually quite against China and Chinese wines. And that was, and I already started, it's been 5 years now, or just about 5 years. And I remember on LinkedIn, people writing me messages that, oh, you know, bottled in China must mean that you guys are doing fake wines. It must mean that you the wines that are being made in China are not real. And there was, I would tell you, and it was a little bit interesting because I'm not a negative person, but it was definitely negative messages. And now it's 360. And when I was talking about China, it was very uncool. You know, when I was talking about Chinese wines early in the days, I remember people saying, oh, all Chinese wines are bad, which is not the case. And I remember nobody being interested. And I remember also we were pitching to media about writing about Ningxia, writing about Yunnan, writing about different wine regions in China, and not one publication could care. Not one publication. And today I'm very grateful that now people come to me and ask for publications or anything that we can work with China. Mm-hmm. And I think it just shows you that the market is evolving, that people are evolving. And there's also credibility when brands like Domaine de Londai, which is a Lafite project, is doing well in China. Ao Yuan, which is a project from LVMH, is doing very well in Yunnan and producing some fantastic wines. We need that. We need brands to showcase high quality production for others to follow. But the podcast itself was always just a passion project. It still is today. And, you know, I do have a day job, so it definitely is something that I love to do. And it was also one of the reasons I started it was just like you, gaining connections, learning. And because I was, you know, in the middle of the MW program, it also served as a way that I could learn more about wine regions, learn more about producers, gain that insight that I always wanted to ask. And I thought, if it's useful for me, it's useful for everybody. And a podcast that we're launching this week is with Howard Kwok, who owns VWK. His family was the first investor, Chinese investor, into Bordeaux. They now have 7 estates. And I sent that to my, you know, MW group and said, hey, you guys wanted to know more about how the Chinese are impacting Bordeaux and buying up chateaus. Here's the raw version of the interview with the information that you can use, for example, in the MW. And so if it's useful for me, I always make a big point in helping others, and it's useful for everybody.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'd missed that you were doing the MW program. I absolutely think that will be massively appreciated, because yeah, through the challenges that we've got at the moment with traveling and all the extra expense, then there may be people are taking fewer trips, and the trips are maybe shorter than they used to be. So yeah, anything that's sort of a little bit more behind the cellar door, and you know, giving people that same level of access. I personally think that podcasting is an amazing way to do that, because it's been my experience that producers are maybe less wary, less self-conscious when there's a microphone rather than when there's a sort of a big film crew with cameras and lights and all of these things, and that maybe you actually get something that's a little bit more akin to if you just sort of lean on a barrel next to them, rather than something which is they feel needs to be more polished, and maybe you get to a little bit more closer to what they would probably say to some of their winemaker friends than something that they're sort of saying for the trade, as it were.
Well, I'm sure that they polish it up a little bit because they do know it's going to be publicly shared. And when you get to the winery and you start making it, you realize it's a different world. Having said that, though, I think there's always bits that we can learn from every podcast. And just like yourselves, you know, when you're driving or you're doing work, I always listen to podcasts in the morning when I'm getting ready. So the more you can do to learn and just have a more global view of the industry, I think is fascinating, because it doesn't only revolve around France or about the UK market or US market. And so, you know, if you wanted to stop by and learn about wine from your podcast, and then stop by and learn about business in China or Asia, my podcast, and then just, you know, dipping your hands into different subjects that just make you interested, I think make you a little bit more well-rounded, make you well-spoken when it comes to the world of wine, because it's no longer one country. It's become a global market. And to have that knowledge about what's really going on in Asia, I think also brings a lot of credibility to the table if you are a professional in the industry.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, you're preaching to the converted. I definitely agree. I think, getting multiple different angles, and, you know, in such an easily consumed format, it's a huge win-win. I'd like to do a really kind of geographically, I guess, link you from California, I think, to the Pacific Northwest, and then back to China. I think the link there between those three places is actually the educational work that I believe you've done with Wine Folly and other organizations who are, you know, keen to tap your knowledge and to sort of, I guess in a sense, kind of amplify and join that mission that you started out with to bring more of what's happening in China to the outside world. So I'd like to sort of, you know, be on that same route as well, on that same wave as well. So yeah, I just invite you to maybe, talk a little bit about those opportunities, Wine Folly being one, but I'm sure there are many others as well. And then perhaps, you know, to lead into a bit of an overview again, you know, back at that sort of 30,000 foot view. What are some of the major wine regions in China? What might be some of the key differences, and what might be some of the different styles and even grapes that may be growing in those regions?
So actually, if you take a look at Wine Folly, you'll have a lot of great research, and she's just fantastic. So that was a really great opportunity. But yes, I've been writing and contributing to various publications, Harper's in the UK, as well as wine, different wine business publications. And I think it's always usually been about China, but also either from e-commerce standpoint in China, which I think was a great one that we did with Wine Monthly. I want to say I'll pull it out for your listeners later, but that's a great one.
We'll link it up in the description.
Certainly, if you want to learn more about how actually to do business online in China. And so, yes, opportunities came because, of course, speaking about China and being an advocate for the region. And then also I don't know how I got entrapped into that, but also writing quite a lot when it came to sustainability in wine packaging, which is shocking to me because wine in China, the heavier the bottle, the better it is, so it's quite, quite opposite of what actually is happening in China, but still an interesting topic just because, our podcast does cover a lot when it comes to sustainability, as it's one of my passions as well. So one of the things when it comes to China is that once again, wine in China, I invite all of your listeners, if they tasted a bottle of wine and they were disappointed and it was about 10 years ago, well, you should probably taste it again for the mere fact that it has evolved. And then taste it again in 10 years and see how the wine is evolving because the producers are young and they're vibrant and they're excited. So when it comes to China, it is a very large region. A lot of regions do make wine, but the key ones that we're going to dive into today with your listeners are three key regions. And we're going to talk about Shandong, Ningxia, and Yunnan. Shandong was actually the first region to produce wine. Now, this is about, I want to say, an hour and a half when it comes to, a plane ride away from Beijing. So we're near Beijing, but we're on the coast, if that makes sense. And Shandong province actually accounts for about 40% of the wine produced in China. So it is the largest winemaking region in China. It was first, all eyes were on Shandong for the mere fact that on terms of latitude, it basically goes with Bordeaux. And they thought, well, it's next to water. So there you be another check right there. It feels like Bordeaux because we are next to the water. And so they started to build all these fake chateaus out. So when you go, it looks like a Disneyland. It's incredible and interesting, I would say. Interesting is a nice word. And, the problem with that region is, yes, it's old, but huge monsoons in springtime, which means huge issues with water and rot. And as we know, just because on the same line, you have another winemaking region, it does not mean that your microclimate is the same. And you know that better than anybody knows that. So one of the things is that, of course, today we don't always talk about Shandong as the premium wine producing region of China, but in terms of historic reasons, it's worth mentioning. So that's one of the key problems there. The benefit to Shandong, and we're going to talk about that in other regions, is that Shandong does not need to do burial. So there's not an issue of having extreme frost in the way that another region in China that we will talk about does. But the key producer there, in terms of quality, not in terms of volume, but quality, and the most exciting one, is called Domaine de Longdai. And Domaine de Longdai is a project which is with Lafite Group. And that was done a while back. And there's a two-part podcast on that with the technical manager at Domaine de Longdai, Denise. And we talk about how to make wine in China and in particular in Shandong. And just to say things, they have some great wine on some good vintages, but they didn't release every vintage. So that should give us an idea of how difficult it is to make wine there. I'm not trying to put anything bad out there because it's a small industry, but definitely when you think that a producer like them are holding back vintages because they're not proud of the quality, it should say a lot about the wine climate, right? It's a maritime climate, but definitely very rainy. The next region we're going to go to is actually called Ningxia. And I want to ask Lawrence, have you heard of that region before?
No, I'll be honest. No, I haven't.
I don't expect anybody to. So don't worry, it's not a trick question. recently in the last month, I've seen three or four articles come out that Ningxia is the next Bordeaux of China, is the next top region of China.
Sorry, could you maybe just spell it for us so that we can...
Ningxia is Ningxia. And I'll write that down for everybody later on.
Yeah. Okay.
But Ningxia and where its position, I'm even trying to figure that out, where its position is northwestern China. And it's basically in a desert. And when you fly there to the wine region, you're going, there's nobody that lives out here. It literally, as you fly over, it's just dunes and dunes and dunes. And then you get to a city. That's how it looks like. It's really fascinating landscape. For a moment, I woke up in an airplane. I was like, am I on Mars? Where am I? That's how crazy it is, the surrounding. So they have a lot of sandstorms, you know? So again, these wine regions are really in incredible spots. But Ningxia is a very unique region in that it's the smallest province in China, often overlooked. You never hear about it. People think of China, they think of Beijing, they think of Shanghai, but you've never heard of Ningxia. And most people have never heard because it's the smallest province. Mm-hmm. And one of the things with Ningxia is that it's also used to be one of the poorest provinces in China. So there's a huge push by the government to make this a good wine region because, well, there's jobs and it brings in money and there brings in tourism. So there's a huge push in terms of the government to build up this region. So the government's very heavily involved in the wine making and growing in that region. It encompasses about 93,000 acres. There's about over 200 wineries now. So it's not a small winemaking region. And the key feature or microclimate is that there's a mountain called the foothill of Helan Shan or Helan Mountain, H-E-L-A-N. And that foothill, that's where the vineyards are at the bottom. And when you go, sometimes the soil has these big, big rocks. It reminds me of Chateau Neuf-du-Pape, except it's the rest of it's silty. And the big problem with this region is every year they need to bury the vines because the frost is, it's a very dramatic growing season, extremely hot and dry in summer, and then very cold. And the cold is a very arid cold in winter. And therefore there's a lot of problems with growing vines in winter. So you need to bury the vines and all that has to be done manually, right? You can't really, you can probably till it for the most part, but to dig it out is all manual. So there's a lot of work that goes into these vineyards and incredibly low yields because the soil is very, very poor. You basically, it looks like a desert and then you've got these big, big rocks as well. So it's a very poor soil. And the key grapes here is going to be Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Marcelin, and Marcelin is now being approved in Bordeaux as well as a small minority in the vineyards due to climate change. And Marcelin was created in southern France in 1961 by Paul Truel, and it is a crossing of Cabernet Sauvignon and Grenache. And I think it's a great grape because it's definitely more resistant to disease, which is what's needed in Shandong province, and easier to grow than a delicate grape like Pinot. So the main grapes in Ningxia is obviously Cabernet Sauvignon. And so, you know, again, I'm kind of diving into these. There's 100 things that I could say about it. Yeah. So I guess the last one that I think is the most interesting and exciting is in Yunnan. And Yunnan is right on the border of Tibet. Mm. So where the wine's being made is super high altitude. People compare this almost to Mendoza. And there's definitely this huge diurnal temperature, which is really beautiful cold mornings and cold evenings and sunny, bright days. So that's the, I would say, the future of premium producers in China. You cannot do any volume. The benefits of Ningxia is that it's majorly flat, but in Yunnan, because it's on mountains, you really can only really do small lots. And so that I think is in itself a really great thing. And the producers here are coming from everywhere. The top producer is obviously Aoyun, which is a LVMH product out in Yunnan, and it's doing quite well. And then you also just have this beautiful culture. But those grapes, again, Cabernet Sauvignon, although one of my friends, Alex Xu, is now producing or starting to produce some Syrah and some Pinot. And that, I think, is going to be the future. I mean, ideally, but the problem is the consumer demands Cabernet Sauvignon in China. So, of course, key producers will be growing that. But I think those that have a little bit of a further outlook on wine production probably could aim to have a little bit more Syrah in the region, and perhaps even some Pinot Noir would also be would be possible to grow.
Super interesting to have that sort of high level overview, and as I say, you know, I think what's then incredible to then have is your podcast then to really kind of explore those regions and to go more in depth. So, but thank you for opening the door to us, really, to giving us a flavor and a sense of what's happening there. I think, in terms of thinking about closing, really, the interview, I mean, what I would like to actually do would be actually to, in a sense, ask you to kind of link those regions maybe that you've just spoken about, through to the future of, I guess, wine consumption in China. It sounds as though, there is diversity on one hand. There's three very different types of terroir that you've just described there. But is the consumer kind of matching that? Are they open-minded? Are there differences in terms of age as well? So, I know it's sort of looking into the crystal ball a little bit. Or do those wineries look more outside of China? What's your kind of sense of the future and the maybe, the next 10 years for Chinese wine?
Well, my bets are on Chinese wines, and that's for sure. First, a huge push from the government. And, just seeing how the government has has a lot of control over the recent numbers with Australia, control over what products can enter, taxes. When I started working a decade ago, US had a better relationship with China. And so, it was an interesting time where they were finally growing US wines abroad. And then back, I want to say 2017, 2018, mm-hmm. It all came crashing down when the trade war started. So what I would think is that long term, I would bet on Chinese wines more than I would bet on international wines trying to enter China, for the mere reason that there is more protection around Chinese wines. And there's more of a push that the government wants to have Chinese wines at the dinner table. They realize that they're not there just yet. So I feel that they're a little bit more flexible of letting products in, but any day they could raise the taxes so astronomically high that it makes no sense to import that wine in. And then my question is, will people turn to Chinese wine? And I think the answer is yes. Huge push on the government to do marketing for Chinese wines. Ningxia has a vested interest when it comes to the economical development of the region. So Everything aligns that indeed I bet on Chinese wines for China. I do know that Siga Estate has been doing quite well growing their brand in Canada. They have a second shipment going through. I know that Liberty Wines in London carries Kenan wines. And so there is definitely a future, and there's enough consumers around the world who are like us, willing to try interesting wines. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But I would say that the consumer is definitely growing with Chinese wines. The more knowledge they get, the more they are open to trying Chinese wines. And I think what it comes down to is the quality 10 years ago has changed. And as long as we keep moving in the right direction, I don't see a reason why people wouldn't be proud to consume their own wine instead of looking abroad and thinking they should only drink French or only drink Italian. I think that's changing. And I think that China is in the right place at the right time for its own economy and its own growth of its wine regions to have a strong hold, if I may say. And so it'll be interesting to see. The consumers, I think, will be diverse. And I think the young consumer and the old consumer alike is starting to be proud of made in China products, which I didn't see so much so when I was there at the beginning. People were still buying iPhones and still really heavily invested in foreign goods, and they still are today. And I even think for consumption products, they still are very much open to having foreign products. But I think as made in China brand becomes stronger, there's more of a reason to be proud of your own brands. And I think that will come with time. But I definitely see that happening.
Amazing. And final question, really, maybe just to, maybe draw the horizon in a little bit, because that's absolutely fascinating. But I want to kind of end it really on a note about you, really. Just in terms of, maybe looking ahead over the coming months and years, what might be we be expecting for the podcast and how that develops, and your I think imminent return to China post-harvest.
Right. So for the podcast, I definitely want to keep it bottle as China for now. I was thinking maybe bottle just to make it a more global approach, but we'll see about that. And definitely continue to grow the story of what's going on with these fascinating individuals. You'll be joining us as well. So that would be great to get your word out and your story out as well. But, I think the podcast is very much still in line with what I want, which is growing my own knowledge and learning and connecting. And so it still serves that. And I don't see that changing. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely want to continue to bring that value to all the listeners. And yeah, if anybody wants any specific topics or wants to have a little bit more information on a region, I'd be very open to doing that. And, you know, I really hope that it continues to get new people who, just like you, are wine lovers or interested in business in Asia. So hope to see that continuing growing.
If you know someone who would enjoy this episode, please share the direct link, which is interpretingwine.com/460. And if you really enjoyed it, then please leave the episode an iTunes review on the same link. Do see below for Emily's Bottled in China website, from where you can find all episodes and her main social media handles. And of course, I'd love to have you following along with me on social media, where I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, and email hello@interpretingwine.com. Next time on the Interpreting Wine Wine Communication Series, in episode 461, I'll be speaking with Natalie McLean of Unreserved Wine Talk, based in Canada. So make sure you're subscribed to Interpreting Wine wherever you're listening to be alerted when that episode goes live. See you then.